catching the rushing of the night breeze in the elms. Then all four rabbits sat as though transfixed by the sudden, blinding light that poured over them like a cloudburst. Their very instinct was numbed in this terrible glare. The dog barked and then became silent once more. Dandelion tried to move, but could not. The awful brightness seemed to cut into his brain. The car, which had driven up the lane and over the brow under the elms, came on a few more yards and stopped.
"Lucy's rabbits is out, look!"
"Ah, best get in quick, leave lights on!"
The sound of men's voices from somewhere beyond the fierce light brought Hazel to his senses. He could not see, but nothing, he realized, had happened to his hearing or his nose. He shut his eyes and at once knew where he was.
"Dandelion, Haystack, shut your eyes and run," he said.
A moment later, he smelled the lichen and cool moisture of one of the staddle stones. He was under the barn. Dandelion was near him, and a little further away was Haystack. Outside, the men's boots scraped and grated over the stones.
"That's it, get round behind then.
He won't go far."
"Pick it up, then."
Hazel moved across to Haystack. "I'm afraid we'll have to leave Laurel," he said. "Just follow me." Keeping under the raised floor of the barn, they all three scuttled back toward the elm trees. The men's voices were left behind. Coming out into the grass near the lane, they found the darkness behind the headlights full of the fumes of exhaust, a hostile, choking smell that added to their confusion. Haystack sat down once more and could not be persuaded to move.
"Shouldn't we leave her, Hazel-Ra?"
asked Dandelion.
"After all, the men won't hurt her. They've caught Laurel and taken him back to the hutch."
"If it was a buck, I'd say yes," said Hazel. "But we need this doe. That's what we came for."
At this moment, they caught the smell of burning white sticks and heard the men returning up the farmyard. There was a metallic bumping as they rummaged in the car. The sound seemed to rouse Haystack. She looked round at Dandelion.
"I don't want to go back to the hutch," she said.
"You're sure?" asked Dandelion.
"Yes. I'll go with you."
Dandelion immediately turned for the hedgerow. It was only when he had crossed it and reached the ditch beyond that he realized that he was on the opposite side of the lane from that on which they had first approached. He was in a strange ditch. However, there seemed to be nothing to worry about. The ditch led down the slope, and that was the way home. He moved slowly along it, waiting for Hazel to join him. Hazel had crossed the lane a few moments after Dandelion and Haystack. Behind him, he heard the men moving away from the Hrududu. As he topped the bank, the beam of a torch shone up the lane and picked out his red eyes and white tail disappearing into the hedge.
"There's old Wild Rabbit, look! I reckon rest of ours ain't so far off. Got up there with un, see? Let's go and have a look."
In the ditch, Hazel overtook Haystack and Dandelion under a clump of brambles.
"Get on quickly if you can," he said to Haystack. "The men are just behind."
"We can't get on, Hazel," said Dandelion, "without leaving the ditch. It's blocked."
Hazel sniffed ahead. Immediately beyond the brambles, the ditch was closed by a pile of earth, weeds, and rubbish. They would have to come into the open. Already the men were over the bank, and the torchlight was flickering up and down the hedgerow and through the brambles above their very heads. Then, only a few yards away, footfalls vibrated along the edge of the ditch. Hazel turned to Dandelion.
"Listen," he said. "I'm going to run across the corner of the field, from this ditch to the other one, so that they see me. They'll try to shine that light on me for sure. While they're doing that, you and Haystack climb the bank, get into the lane and run down to the Swede shed. You can hide there and I'll join you. Ready?"
There was no time to argue. A moment later, Hazel broke almost under the men's feet and ran across the field.
"Here he goes! Cake torch on him then! Nice and steady!"
Dandelion and Haystack scrambled over the bank and dropped into the lane. Hazel, with the torch beam behind him, had almost reached the other ditch when he felt a sharp blow on one of his hind legs and a hot, stinging pain along his side. The report of the cartridge sounded an instant later. As he somersaulted into a clump of nettles in the ditch bottom, he remembered vividly the scent of bean flowers at sunset. He had not known that the men had a gun. Hazel crawled through the nettles, dragging his injured leg. In a few moments, the men would shine their torch on him and pick him up. He stumbled along the inner wall of the ditch, feeling the blood flowing over his foot. Suddenly, he was aware of a draft against one side of his nose, a smell of damp, rotten matter, and a hollow, echoing sound at his very ear. He was beside the mouth of a land drain, which emptied into the ditch, a smooth, cold tunnel, narrower than a rabbit hole, but wide enough. With flattened ears and belly pressed to the wet floor, he crawled up it, pushing a little pile of thin mud in front of him, and lay still as he felt the thud of boots coming nearer.
"I don't rightly know, John, whether you hit it or not."
"Ah, you done all right. That's blood down there, see?"
"Ah, well, but that don't signify. He might be a long ways off by now. I reckon you lost he."
"I reckon he's in them nettles."
"Have a look, then."
"No, he ain't."
"Well, us can't go biggering up and down here half bloody night. We got to catch them as get out of the hutch. They'll not have fire be rights, John. Frightened day off, see? You can have a look for him tomorrow if he's here."
The silence returned, but still Hazel lay motionless in the whispering chill of the tunnel. A cold lassitude came over him, and he passed into a dreaming, inert stupor full of cramp and pain. After a time, a thread of blood began to trickle over the lip of the drain into the trampled, deserted ditch. Bigwig, crouched close to Blackberry in the straw of the cattle shed, leaped to flight at the sound of the shot 200 yards up the lane. He checked himself and turned to the others.
"Don't run," he said quickly. "What do you want to run to anyway? No holes here."
"Further away from the gun,"
replied Blackberry, white-eyed.
"Wait," said Bigwig, listening. "They're running down the lane. Can't you hear them?"
"I can only hear two rabbits,"
answered Blackberry, after a pause,
"and one of them sounds exhausted."
They looked at each other and waited. Then Bigwig got up again.
"Stay here, all of you,"
he said. "I'll go and bring them in." Out on the verge, he found Dandelion, urging Haystack, who was lamed and spent.
"Come in here, quickly," said Bigwig. "For Frith's sake, where's Hazel?"
"The men have shot him,"
replied Dandelion. They reached the other five rabbits in the straw. Dandelion did not wait for their questions.
"They've shot Hazel,"
he said.
"They've caught that Laurel and put him back in the hutch. Then they came after us. The three of us were at the end of a blocked ditch. Hazel went out of his own accord to distract their attention while we got away, but we didn't know they had a gun."
"Are you sure they killed him?"
said Speedwell.
"I didn't actually see him hit, but they were very close to him."
"We'd better wait," said Bigwig.
They waited a long time. At last, Dandelion and Bigwig went cautiously back up the lane. They found the bottom of the ditch trampled by boots and streaked with blood, and returned to tell the others. The journey back, with the three limping hutch rabbits, lasted more than 2 weary hours. All were dejected and wretched. When at last they reached the foot of the down, Bigwig told Blackberry, Speedwell, and Hawkbit to leave them and go on to the warren. They approached the wood just at first light, and a rabbit ran to meet them through the wet grass. It was Fiver. Blackberry stopped and waited beside him, while the other two went on in silence.
"Fiver,"
he said,
"there's bad news.
Hazel."
"I know," replied Fiver. "I know now."
"How do you know?"
asked Blackberry, startled.
"As you came through the grass just now,"
said Fiver, very low,
"there was a fourth rabbit behind you, limping and covered with blood. I ran to see who it was. And then there were only three of you, side by side."
He paused and looked across the down, as though still seeking the bleeding rabbit who had vanished in the half-light. Then, as Blackberry said nothing more, he asked,
"Do you know what happened?"
When Blackberry had told his news, Fiver returned to the warren and went underground to his empty burrow. A little later,
Bigwig brought the hutch rabbits up the hill and at once called everyone to meet in the honeycomb. Fiver did not appear. It was a dismal welcome for the strangers. Not even Bluebell could find a cheerful word. Dandelion was inconsolable to think that he might have stopped Hazel breaking from the ditch. The meeting came to an end in a dreary silence and a half-hearted sylphlay. Later that morning, Holly came limping into the warren. Of his three companions, only Silver was alert and unharmed. Buckthorn was wounded in the face, and Strawberry was shivering and evidently ill from exhaustion. There were no other rabbits with them. Chapter 26 Fiver Beyond. On his dreadful journey, after the shaman has wandered through dark forests and over great ranges of mountains, he reaches an opening in the ground. The most difficult stage of the adventure now begins. The depths of the underworld open before him. Uno Harver, quoted by Joseph Campbell in The Hero with a Thousand Faces. Fiver lay on the earth floor of the burrow. Outside, the downs were still in the intense, bright heat of noon. The dew and gossamer had dried early from the grass, and by mid-morning, the finches had fallen silent. Now, along the lonely expanses of wiry turf, the air wavered. On the footpath that led past the warren, bright threads of light, watery, a mirage, trickled and glittered across the shortest, smoothest grass. From a distance, the trees along the edge of the beach hangar appeared full of great, dense shadows, impenetrable to the dazzled eye. The only sound was the zip-zip of the grasshoppers, the only scent that of the warm thyme. In the burrow, Fiver slept, and woke uneasily through the heat of the day, fidgeting and scratching as the last traces of moisture dried out of the earth above him. Once, when a trickle of powdery soil fell from the roof, he leaped out of sleep and was in the mouth of the run before he came to himself and returned to where he had been lying. Each time he woke, he remembered the loss of Hazel and suffered once more the knowledge that had pierced him as the shadowy, limping rabbit disappeared in the first light of morning on the down. Where was that rabbit now? Where had it gone? He began to follow it among the tangled paths of his own thoughts, over the cold, dew-wet ridge, and down into the dawn mist of the fields below. The mist swirled round Fiver as he crept through thistles and nettles. Now he could no longer see the limping rabbit ahead. He was alone and afraid, yet perceiving old, familiar sounds and smells, those of the field where he was born. The thick weeds of summer were gone. He was under the bare ash boughs and the flowering blackthorn of March. He was crossing the brook, going up the slope toward the lane, toward the place where Hazel and he had come upon the notice board. Would the board still be there? He looked timidly up the slope. The view was blotted with mist, but as he neared the top, he saw a man busy over a pile of tools, a spade, a rope and other smaller implements, the use of which he did not know. The notice board lay flat on the ground. It was smaller than he remembered, and fixed to a single long square post, sharpened at the further end, to put into the earth. The surface of the board was white, just as he had seen it before, and covered with the sharp black lines like sticks. Fiver came hesitantly up the slope and stopped close to the man, who stood looking down into a deep, narrow hole sunk in the ground at his feet. The man turned to Fiver with a kind of amiability that an ogre might show to a victim, whom they both know that he will kill and eat as soon as it suits him to do so.
"Ah, and what am I doing, eh?" asked the man.
"What are you doing?" answered Fiver, staring, twitching with fear.
"I'm just putting up this here old board," said the man. "And I suppose you wants to know what for, eh?"
"Yes," whispered Fiver.
"It's for that there old Hazel," said the man. "Only where to see, we got to put up a bit of a notice, like on his account. What you reckon it says, eh?"
"I don't know," said Fiver. "How can a board say anything?"
"Ah, but it do, see," replied the man. "That's where we knows what you done. That's why we kills you when we has a mind to. Now, you once take a good look at that there board, and then very likely you'll know more than what you knows now."
In the livid, foggy twilight, Fiver stared at the board. As he stared, the black sticks flickered on the white surface. They raised their sharp, wedge-shaped little heads and chattered together, like a nestful of young weasels. The sound, mocking and cruel, came faintly to his ears, as though muffled by sand or sacking.
"In memory of Hazel Ra! In memory of Hazel Ra! In memory of Hazel Ra!"
"Well, that's where it is, see," said the man. "And I've got to hang him up on this here board. That's to say, soon's I gets it stood up proper. Same as you'd hang up Jay, like our old stoat. Ah, go and hang him up."
"No," cried Fiver. "No, you shan't."
"Only I ain't got him, see," went on the man. "Only I ain't got him, see," went on the man. "That's why I can't get done. I can't hang him up, 'cause he've gone down a bloody hole. That's where he've gone. He've gone down a bloody hole, just when I got in line and all, and I can't get in out."
Fiver crept up to the man's boots and peered into the hole. It was circular, a cylinder of baked earthenware that disappeared vertically into the ground. He called,
"Hazel! Hazel!"
Far down in the hole, something moved, and he was about to call again. Then the man bent down and hit him between the ears. Fiver was struggling in a thick cloud of earth, soft and powdery. Someone was saying,
"Steady, Fiver, steady!"
He sat up. There was soil in his eyes, his ears and nostrils. He could not smell. He shook himself and said,
"Who is it?" "It's Blackberry. I came to see how you were. It's all right, a bit of the roof's fallen, that's all. There have been falls all over the warren today. It's the heat. Anyway, it woke you from a nightmare, if I know anything. You were thrashing about and calling out for Hazel. You poor old chap. What a miserable thing it is to have happened. We must try to bear it as best we can. We've all got to stop running one day, you know. They say Frith knows all the rabbits, every one."
"Is it evening?" asked Fiver.
"Not yet, no. But it's a fair time after Neafrith. Holly and the others have come back, you know. Strawberry's very ill, and I haven't any dose with them. Not one. Everything's as bad as it could be. Holly's still asleep. He was completely exhausted. He said he'd tell us what happened this evening. When we told him about poor Hazel, he said, 'Fiver, you're not listening. I expect you'd rather I kept quiet.'"
"Blackberry," said Fiver, "do you know the place where Hazel was shot?"
"Yes. Bigwig and I went and looked at the ditch before we came away. But you mustn't..."
"Could you go there with me now?"
"Go back there? Oh, no. It's a long way, Fiver. And what will be the good? The risk and this fearful heat, and you'd only make yourself wretched."
"Hazel isn't dead," said Fiver.
"Yes, the men took him away. Fiver, I saw the blood."
"Yes, but you didn't see Hazel, because he isn't dead. Blackberry, you must do what I ask."
"You're asking too much."
"Then I shall have to go alone. but what I'm asking you to do is to come and save Hazel's life.
When at last Blackberry had reluctantly given in, and they had set out down the hill, Fiver went almost as fast as though he were running for cover. Again and again he urged Blackberry to make haste. The fields were empty in the glare. Every creature bigger than a bluebottle was sheltering from the heat. When they reached the outlying sheds beside the lane, Blackberry began to explain how he and Bigwig had gone back to search. But Fiver cut him short.
"We have to go up the slope, I know that. But you must show me the ditch."
The elms were still. There was not the least sound in the leaves. The ditch was thick with cow parsley, hemlock, and long trails of green flowering bryony. Blackberry led the way to the trampled patch of nettles, and Fiver sat still among them, sniffing and looking about him in the silence. Blackberry watched him disconsolately. A faint breath of wind stole across the fields, and a blackbird began to sing from somewhere beyond the elms. At last Fiver began to move along the bottom of the ditch. The insects buzzed round his ears, and suddenly a little cloud of flies flew up, disturbed from a projecting stone. No, not a stone. It was smooth and regular, a circular lip of earthenware. The brown mouth of a drain, stained black at the lower edge by a thin, dried thread of blood, of rabbit's blood.
"The bloody hole," whispered Fiver.
"The bloody hole."
He peered into the dark opening. It was blocked. Blocked by a rabbit. That was plain to be smelled. A rabbit whose faint pulse could just be heard, magnified in the confined tunnel.
"Hazel," said Fiver.
Blackberry was beside him at once.
"What is it, Fiver?"
"Hazel's in that hole," said Fiver. "And he's alive."
Chapter 27. You can't imagine it unless you've been there.
"My God bless, never I see such a people. Signor Piozzi," quoted by Cecilia Thrale.
In the honeycomb, Bigwig and Holly were waiting to begin the second meeting since the loss of Hazel. As the air began to cool, the rabbits woke, and first one and then another came down the runs that led from the smaller burrows. All were subdued and doubtful at heart. Like the pain of a bad wound, the effect of a deep shock takes some while to be felt. When a child is told for the first time in his life that a person he has known is dead, although he does not disbelieve it, he may well fail to comprehend it, and later ask, perhaps more than once, where the dead person is and when he is coming back. When Pipkin had planted it himself, like some sombre tree, the knowledge that Hazel would never return, his bewilderment exceeded his grief, and this bewilderment he saw on every side among his companions. Faced with no crisis of action and with nothing to prevent them from continuing their life in the warren as before, the rabbits were nevertheless overcome by the conviction that their luck was gone. Hazel was dead, and Holly's expedition had totally failed. What would follow? Holly, gaunt, his staring pelt full of goose grass and fragments of burdock, was talking with the three hutch rabbits and reassuring them as best he could. No one could say now that Hazel had thrown away his life in a foolhardy prank. The two does were the only gain that anyone had made, the warren's only asset. But they were plainly so ill at ease in their new surroundings that Holly was already contending against his own belief that there was little to be hoped for from them. Does who are upset and on edge tend to be infertile. And how were these does to make themselves at home in strange conditions and a place where everyone was lost so poorly in his thoughts? They would die, perhaps, or wander away. He buckled once more to the task of explaining that he was sure better times lay ahead, and as he did so, felt himself the least convinced of any.
Bigwig had sent Acorn to see whether there was anyone still to come. Acorn returned to say that Strawberry felt too ill, and that he could find neither Blackberry nor Fiver.
"We'll leave Fiver," said Bigwig. "Poor fellow. He'll feel better by himself for a time, I dare say."
"He's not in his burrow, though," said Acorn.
"Never mind," said Bigwig. But the thought came to him. Fiver and Blackberry. Could they have left the warren without telling anyone? If they have, what will happen when the others get to know? Should he ask Kahar to go and look for them while there was still light? But if Kahar found them, what then? They could not be compelled to return. Or if they were, what good would that do if they wanted to be gone? At that moment, Holly began to speak, and everyone became quiet.
"We all know we're in a mess," said Holly. "And I suppose before long we shall have to talk about what's best to be done. But I thought that, first of all, I ought to tell you how it is that we four, Silver, Buckthorn, Strawberry and I, have come back without any dues. You don't have to remind me that when we set out, everyone thought it was going to be straightforward. And here we are, one rabbit sick, one wounded, and nothing to show for it. You're all wondering why. No one's blaming you, Holly," said Bigwig. "I don't know whether I'm to blame or not," replied Holly. "But you'll tell me that when you've heard the story." That morning when we left, it was good weather for Hlessel on the move, and we all felt there was no hurry. It was cool, I remember, and looked as if it would be some time before the day got really bright and cloudless. There's a farm not far away from the other end of this wood, and although there were no men about so early, I didn't fancy going that way. So we kept up on high ground on the evening side. We were all expecting to come to the edge of the down, but there isn't any steep edge as there is on the north. The upland just goes on and on, open, dry, lonely. There's plenty of cover for rabbits, standing corn hedges and banks, but no real woodland. Just great, open fields of light soil with big white flintstones. I was hoping that we might find ourselves in the sort of country we used to know, meadows and woods, but we didn't. Anyhow, we found a track with a good thick hedge along one side, and we decided to follow that. We took it easy and stopped a good deal, because I was taking care to avoid running into Elil. I'm sure it's bad country for stoats as well as foxes, and I hadn't much idea what we were going to do if we met one. I'm pretty certain we did pass close to a weasel, said Silver. I could smell it, but you know how it is with Elil. They're not actually hunting. They often take no notice of you. We left very little scent, and buried our raka as though we were cats. Well before Nifrith, went on Holly, the track brought us to a long, thin wood running right across the way we were going. These downland woods are queer, aren't they? This was no thicker than the one above us now, but it stretched as far as we could see either way in a dead straight line. I don't like straight lines. Men make them. And sure enough, we found a road beside this wood. It was a very lonely, empty road, but all the same, I didn't want to hang about there, so we went straight through the wood and out the other side. Kahar spotted us in the fields beyond and told us to alter our direction. I asked him how we were getting on, and he said we were about halfway, so I thought we might as well start looking for somewhere to lie up for the night. I didn't fancy the open, and in the end, we made scrapes in the bottom of a kind of little pit we found. Then we had a good feed, passed the night very well. I don't think we need to tell you everything about the journey. It came on to rain just after the morning feed, and there was a nasty cold wind with it, so we stayed where we were until after Nifrith. It brightened up then, and we went on. The going wasn't very nice because of the wet, but by early evening, I reckon we ought to be near the place. I was looking round when a hare came through the grass, and I asked him whether he knew of a big warren close by.
Ephrathah,
he asked. Are you going to Ephrathah? If that's what it's called, I answered.
Do you know it?
No, I said. We don't. We want to know where it is. Well, he said, my advice to you is to run, and quickly. I was just wondering what to make of that when suddenly three big rabbits came over the bank, just the way I did that night when I came to arrest you, Bigwig. And one of them said, can I see your marks?
Marks?
I said. What marks? I don't understand.
You're not from Ephrathah?
No, I said. We're going there. We're strangers. Will you come with me? No. Have you come far, or are you wet through, or anything like that? So then these three rabbits took us off down the bank, and that was how we came to Ephrathah, as they call it. And I'd better try and tell you something about it, so that you'll know what a dirty little bunch of snivelling head scrapers we are here. Ephrathah is a big warren, a good deal bigger than the one we came from. The three errors, I mean. And the one fear of every rabbit in it is that men are going to find them and infect them with the white blindness. The whole warren is organized to conceal its existence. The holes are all hidden, and the Owsler have every rabbit in the place under orders. You can't call your life your own, and in return, you have safety, if it's worth having at the price you pay. As well as the Owsler, they have what they call a council, and each of the council rabbits has some special thing he looks after. One looks after feeding, another's responsible for the ways in which they keep hidden, another looks after breeding, and so on. As far as the ordinary rabbits are concerned, only a certain number can be above ground at one time. Every rabbit is marked when he's a kitten. They bite them, deep under the chin, or in a haunch or forepaw. Then they can be told by the scar for the rest of their lives. You mustn't be found above ground unless it's the right time of day for your mark.
Who's to stop you?
Growled Bigwig. That's the really frightening part. The Owsler. Well, you can't imagine it unless you've been there. The chief is a rabbit named Wundwurt. General Wundwurt, they call him. I'll tell you more about him in a minute. Then under him, there are captains, each one in charge of a mark, and each captain has his own officers and sentries. There's a mark captain with his band on duty at every time of the day and night. If a man happens to come anywhere near, which isn't often, the sentries give warning long before he comes close enough to see anything. They give warning of Elil, too. They prevent anyone dropping Chaka, except in special places in the ditches where it's buried. And if they see any rabbit above ground whom they don't recognize as having the right to be there, they ask to see his mark. Frith knows what happens if he can't explain himself, but I can guess pretty well. Rabbits in Ephrathah quite often go days at a time without the sight of Frith. If their marks on night sylphlay, then they feed by night, wet or fine, warm or cold. They're all used to talking, playing and mating in the burrows underground. If a mark can't sylphlay at their appointed time for some reason or other, say there was a man working somewhere near, that's just too bad. They miss their turn till next day.
But surely it alters them very much, living like that?
Asked Dandelion.
Very much indeed, replied Holly. Most of them can't do anything but what they're told. They've never been out of Ephrathah, and never smelled an enemy. The one aim of every rabbit in Ephrathah is to get into the Owsler, because of the privileges. And the one aim of everyone in the Owsler is to get into the council. The council have the best of everything, but the Owsla have to keep very strong and tough. They take it in turn to do what they call wide patrol. They go out over the country, all round the place, living in the open for days at a time. It's partly to find out anything they can, and partly to train them and make them tough and cunning. Any Hlesel they find, they pick up and bring back to Ephrafa. If they won't come, they kill them. They reckon Hlesel a danger, because they may attract the attention of men. The wide patrols report back to General Wundwort, and the council decide what to do about anything new that they think may be dangerous.
They missed you on the way in, then? Said Bluebell.
Oh, no, they didn't. We learned later that sometime after we'd been brought in by this rabbit, Captain Campion, our runner arrived from a wide patrol to say that they'd picked up the track of three or four rabbits coming toward Ephrafa from the north, and were there any orders. He was sent back to say that we were safely under control. Anyway, this Captain Campion took us down to a hole in the ditch. The mouth of the hole was a bit of old earthenware pipe, and if a man had pulled it out, the opening would have fallen in and showed no trace of the run inside. And there he handed us over to another captain, because he had to go back above ground for the rest of his spell of duty, you see. We were taken to a big burrow and told to make ourselves at home. There were other rabbits in the burrow, and it was by listening to them and asking questions that I learned most of what I've been telling you. We got talking to some of the does, and I made friends with one called Heisenfley. I told her about our problem here and why we'd come, and then she told us about Ephrafa. When she'd finished, I said, "It sounds terrible. Has it always been like this?" She said no. Her mother had told her that in years gone by, the Warren had been elsewhere and much smaller. But when General Wundwort came, he'd made the move to Ephrafa, and then he'd worked out this whole system of concealment and perfected it until rabbits in Ephrafa were as safe as stars in the sky. Most rabbits here die of old age unless the Owsler kill them off, she said. But the trouble is, there are more rabbits now than the Warren can hold. Any fresh digging that's allowed has to be done under Owsler supervision, and they do it terribly slowly and carefully. It all has to be hidden, you see. We're overcrowded, and a lot of rabbits don't get above ground as much as they need to. And for some reason, there are not enough bucks and too many does. A lot of us have found we can't produce litters because of the overcrowding, but no one is ever allowed to leave. Only a few days ago, several of us does went to the council and asked whether we could form an expedition to start a new warren somewhere else. We said we'd go far, far away as they liked, but they wouldn't hear of it. Not on any account. Things can't go on like this. The system's breaking down. But it doesn't do to be heard talking about it. Well, I thought, this sounds hopeful. Surely they won't object to our proposals. We only want to take a few does and no bucks. They've got more does than there's room for, and we want to take them further away than anyone here could ever have been. A little later, another captain came and said we were to come with him to the council meeting. The council meet in a kind of big burrow. It's long and rather narrow. Not as good as this honeycomb of ours, because they've got no tree roots to make a wide roof. We had to wait outside while they were talking about all sorts of other things. We were just one piece of daily council business, strangers apprehended. There was another rabbit waiting, and he was under special guard. Auslafar, they called them, the council police. I've never been near anyone so frightened in my life. I thought he'd go mad with fear. I asked one of these Auslafar what was the matter, and he said that this rabbit, Blackavar,
had been caught trying to run away from the warren. Well, they took him inside, and first of all, we heard the poor fellow trying to explain himself. And then he was crying and begging for mercy. And when he came out, they'd ripped both his ears to shreds, worse than this one of mine. We were all sniffing at him, absolutely horror-stricken. But one of the Auslöfer said, "You needn't make such a fuss. He's lucky to be alive." So while we were chewing on that, someone came out and said the council were ready for us. As soon as we got in, we were put up in front of this General Wundwert, and he really is a grim customer. I don't think even you'd match up to him, Bigwig. He's almost as big as a hare, and there's something about his mere presence that frightens you, as if blood and fighting and killing were all just part of the day's work to him. I thought he'd begin by asking us some questions about who we were and what we wanted, but he didn't do anything like that. He said, "I'm going to explain the rules of the warren and the conditions on which you'll live here. You must listen carefully, because the rules are to be kept, and any breaking of them will be punished." So then I spoke up at once and said that there was a misunderstanding. "We were an embassy," I said, "come from another warren to ask for Efrafa's goodwill and help." And I went on to explain that all we wanted was their agreement to our persuading a few does to come back with us. When I'd finished, General Wundwort said that it was out of the question. There was nothing to discuss. I replied that we'd like to stay with them for a day or two and try to persuade them to change their mind. "Oh yes," he said, "you'll stay, but there'll be no further occasion for you to take up the council's time, for the next few days at any rate." I said that seemed very hard. Our request was surely a reasonable one, and I was just going to ask them to consider one or two things from our point of view, when another of the councillors, a very old rabbit, said, "You seem to think you are here to argue with us and drive a bargain, but we are the ones to say what you're going to do." I said they should remember that we were representing another warren, even if it was smaller than theirs. We thought of ourselves as their guests, and it was only when I'd said that that I realized with a horrible shock that they thought of us as their prisoners, or as good as prisoners, whatever they might call it. Well, I'd rather say no more about the end of that meeting. Strawberry tried all he could to help me. He spoke very well about the decency and comradeship natural to animals. "Animals don't behave like men," he said. "If they have to fight, they fight. And if they have to kill, they kill. But they don't sit down and set their wits to work to devise ways of spoiling other creatures' lives and hurting them. They have dignity and animality." But it was all no use. At last we fell silent, and General Wundwert said, "The council can't spare any more time for you now, and I shall have to leave it to your mark captain to tell you the rules. You'll join the right flank mark under Captain Bugloss. Later we shall see you again, and you'll find us perfectly friendly and helpful to rabbits who understand what's expected of them." So then the Ausler took us out to join the right flank mark. Apparently Captain Bugloss was too busy to see us, and I took care to keep out of his way, because I thought he might want to start marking us then and there. But soon I began to understand what Heisenethle had meant when she said the system wasn't working properly anymore. The burrows were overcrowded, at least by our standards. It was easy to escape attention. Even in one mark, the rabbits don't all know each other. We found places in a burrow and tried to get some sleep, but early in the night we were woken and told to Silfle. I thought there might be a chance to run for it in the moonlight, but there seemed to be sentries everywhere. And besides the sentries,
the captain kept two runners with him, whose job was to rush off at once in any direction from which an alarm might be given. When we'd fed, we went underground again. Nearly all the rabbits were very subdued and docile. We avoided them, because we meant to escape if we could, and we didn't want to get known. But try as I would, I couldn't think of a plan. We fed again, sometime before Neafrith the next day, and then it was back underground. The time dragged terribly. At last, it must have been as evening was coming on, I joined a little group of rabbits listening to a story. And you know, it was the king's lettuce. The rabbit who was telling it was nowhere near as good as Dandelion, but I listened all the same, just for something to do. And it was when he got to the bit where El Herrera dresses up and pretends to be the doctor at King Darzin's palace that I suddenly had an idea. It was a very risky one, but I thought there was a chance that it might work, simply because every rabbit in Ephrathah usually does what he's told without question. I'd been watching Captain Bugloss, and he struck me as a nice enough fellow, conscientious, and a bit weak, and rather harassed by having more to do than he could really cope with. That night, when we were called to Silfley, it was pitch dark and raining. But you don't bother about a little thing like that in Ephrathah. You're only too glad to get out and get some food. All the rabbits trooped up, and we waited until the very last. Captain Bugloss was out on the bank, with two of his sentries. Silver and the others went out in front of me, and then I came up to him, panting as if I'd been running. "Captain Bugloss." "Yes," he said, "what is it?" "You're wanted by the council at once." "Why, what do you mean?" he asked. "What for?" "No doubt they'll tell you that when they see you," I answered. "I shouldn't keep them waiting if I were you." "Who are you?" he said. "You're not one of the council runners. I know them all. What mark are you?" "I'm not here to answer your questions," I said. "Shall I go back and tell them you won't come?" He looked doubtful at that, and I made as if I were going. But then, all of a sudden, he said, "Very well." He looked awfully frightened, poor fellow. "But who's to take over here while I'm gone?" "I am," I said. "General Wundworth's orders. But come back quickly. I don't want to hang about half the night doing your job." He scuttled off. I turned to the other two and said, "Stay here and look alive, too. I'm going round the sentries." Well, then the four of us ran off into the dark, and sure enough, after we'd gone a little way, two sentries popped up and tried to stop us. We all piled straight into them. I thought they'd run, but they didn't. They fought like mad, and one of them tore Buckthorn all down the nose. But of course there were four of us, and in the end, we broke past them and simply tore across the field. We had no idea which way we were going. What with the rain and the night, we just ran. I think the reason why the pursuit was a bit slow off the mark was because poor old Bugloss wasn't there to give the orders. Anyway, we had a fair start, but presently we could hear that we were being followed, and what was worse, we were being overtaken. The Ephrathan Owsler are no joke, believe me. They're all picked for size and strength, and there's nothing they don't know about moving in wet and darkness. They're all so much afraid of the council that they're not afraid of anything else. It wasn't long before I knew we were in trouble. The patrol that was after us could actually follow us in the dark and rain faster than we could run away, and before long they were close behind. I was just going to tell the others that there was nothing for it but to turn and fight when we came to a great steep bank that seemed to slope almost straight up into the air. It was steeper than this hillside below us here, and the slope seemed to be regular, as if men had made it. Well, there was no time to think about it, so up we went. It was covered with rough grass and bushes. I don't know how far it was to the top exactly, but I should guess it was as high as a well-grown rowan tree, perhaps a bit higher. When we got to the top, we found ourselves on small, light stones that shifted as we ran on them. That gave us away completely. Then we came upon broad, flat pieces of wood and two great fixed bars of metal that made a noise, a kind of low, humming noise in the dark. I was just saying to myself, "This is men's work, all right," when I fell over the other side. I hadn't realized that the whole top of the bank was only a very short distance across, and the other side was just as steep.
I went head over heels down the bank in the dark and fetched up against an elder bush, and there I lay. Holly stopped and fell silent, as though pondering on what he remembered. At last, he said,
"It's going to be very hard to describe to you what happened next. Although all four of us were there, we don't understand it ourselves. But what I'm going to say now is the cold truth. Lord Frith sent one of his great messengers to save us from the Efrathan Ausla. Each one of us had fallen over the edge of the bank in one place or another. Buckthorn, who was half blinded with his own blood, went down almost to the bottom. I'd picked myself up and was looking back at the top. There was just enough light in the sky to see the Efrathans if they came over. And then an enormous thing. I can't give you any idea of it. As big as a 1,000 Hrudadil, bigger, came rushing out of the night. It was full of fire and smoke and light, and it roared and beat on the metal lines until the ground shook beneath it. It drove in between us and the Efrathans like 1,000 thunderstorms with lightning. I tell you, I was beyond being afraid. I couldn't move. The flashing and the noise, they split the whole night apart. I don't know what happened to the Efrathans. Either they ran away or it cut them down. And then suddenly it was gone, and we heard it disappearing, rattling bang, far away in the distance. We were completely alone. For a long time I couldn't move. At last I got up and found the others, one by one, in the dark. None of us said a word. At the bottom of the slope, we discovered a kind of tunnel that went right through the bank from one side to the other. We crept into it and came out on the side where we'd gone up. Then we went a long way through the fields, until I reckoned we must be well clear of Ephrafa. We crawled into a ditch and slept there, all four of us, until morning. There was no reason why anything shouldn't have come and killed us, and yet we knew we were safe. You may think it's a wonderful thing to be saved by Lord Frith in his power. How many rabbits has that happened to, I wonder? But I tell you, it was far more frightening than being chased by the Efrathans. Not one of us will forget lying on that bank in the rain while the fire creature went by above our heads. Why did it come on our account? That's more than we shall ever know. The next morning I cast around a bit, and soon I knew which was the right direction. You know how you always do. The rain had stopped, and we set out. But it was a very hard journey back. We were exhausted long before the end, all except Silver. I don't know what we'd have done without him. We went on for a day and a night without any real rest at all. We all felt that the only thing we wanted to do was to get back here as soon as we could. When I reached the wood this morning, I was just limping along in a bad dream. I'm not really much better than poor old Strawberry, I'm afraid. He never complained, but he'll need a long rest, and I rather think I shall too. And Buckthorn, that's the second bad wound he's had. But that's not the worst now, is it? We've lost Hazel. The worst thing that could have happened. Some of you asked me earlier this evening if I would be Chief Rabbit. I'm glad to know you trust me, but I'm completely done in, and I can't possibly take it on yet. I feel as dry and empty as an autumn puffball. I feel as though the wind could blow my fur away.
Chapter 28. At the Foot of the Hill. Marvellous happy it was to be, alone and yet not solitary, oh, out of terror and dark to come, in sight of home. Walter de la Mare, The Pilgrim.
"You're not too tired to Silfly, are you?"
asked Dandelion. "And at the proper time of day for a change. It's a lovely evening, if my nose says right. We ought to try not to be more miserable than we can help, you know."
"Just before we shall fly," said Bigwig, "can I tell you, Holly, that I don't believe anyone else could have brought himself and three other rabbits safely back out of a place like that."
"Frith meant us to get back," replied Holly. "That's the real reason why we're here."
As he turned to follow Speedwell up the run that led into the wood, he found Clover beside him.
"You and your friends must find it strange to go outside and eat grass," he said. "You'll get used to it, you know. And I can promise you that Hazel Ra was right when he told you it's a better life here than in a hutch. Come with me, and I'll show you a patch of nice, short tail grass, if Bigwig hasn't had it all while I've been away."
Holly had taken to Clover. She seemed more robust and less timid than Boxwood and Haystack, and was evidently doing her best to adapt herself to Warren life. What her stock might be, he could not tell, but she looked healthy.
"I like it underground all right,"
said Clover as they came up into the fresh air. "The closed space is really very much like a hutch, except that it's darker. The difficult thing for us is going to be feeding in the open. We're not used to being free to go where we like, and we don't know what to do. You all act so quickly, and half the time I don't know why. I'd prefer not to feed very far from the hole, if you don't mind." They moved slowly across the sunset grass, nibbling as they went. Clover was soon absorbed in feeding, but Holly stopped continually to sit up and sniff about him at the peaceful empty down. When he noticed Bigwig, a little way off, staring fixedly to the north, he at once followed his gaze.
"What is it?" he asked.
"It's Blackberry,"
replied Bigwig. He sounded relieved. Blackberry came hopping rather slowly down from the skyline. He looked tired out, but as soon as he saw the other rabbits, he came on faster and made his way to Bigwig.
"Where have you been?" asked Bigwig. "And where's Fiver? Wasn't he with you?"
"Fiver's with Hazel," said Blackberry. "Hazel's alive. He's been wounded. It's hard to tell how badly, but he won't die."
The other three rabbits looked at him speechlessly. Blackberry waited, enjoying the effect.
"Hazel's alive?" said Bigwig. "Are you sure?"
"Quite sure," said Blackberry. "He's at the foot of the hill at this very moment, in that ditch where you were the night Holly and Bluebell arrived."
"I can hardly believe it," said Holly. "If it's true, it's the best news I've ever heard in my life. Blackberry, you really are sure? What happened? Tell us."
"Fiver found him," said Blackberry. "Fiver took me with him, nearly all the way back to the farm. Then he went along the ditch and found Hazel gone to ground up a land drain. He was very weak from loss of blood, and he couldn't get out of the drain by himself. We had to drag him by his good hind leg. He couldn't turn round, you see."
"But how on earth did Fiver know?"
"How does Fiver know what he knows? You'd better ask him. When we got Hazel into the ditch, Fiver looked to see how badly he was hurt. He's got a nasty wound in one hind leg, but the bone isn't broken, and he's torn all along one side. We cleaned up the places as well as we could, and then we started out to bring him back. It's taken us a whole evening. Can you imagine it? Daylight, dead silence, and a lame rabbit reeking of fresh blood. Luckily, it's been the hottest day we've had this summer, not a mouse stirring. Time and again, we had to take cover in the cow parsley and rest. I was all on the jump, but Fiver was like a butterfly on a stone. He sat in the grass and combed his ears. 'Don't get upset,' he kept saying. 'There's nothing to worry about. We can take our time.' After what I'd seen, I'd have believed him if he'd said we could hunt foxes. But when we got to the bottom of the hill, Hazel was completely finished, and he couldn't go any further. He and Fiver have taken shelter in the overgrown ditch, and I came on to tell you, and here I am.'"
There was silence while Bigwig and Holly took in the news. At last, Bigwig said, "Will they stay there tonight?"
"I think so," replied Blackberry. "I'm sure Hazel won't be able to manage the hill until he's a good deal stronger."
I'll go down there, said Bigwig. I can help to make the ditch a bit more comfortable, and probably Fiver will be able to do with someone else to help to look after Hazel.
I should hurry then, if I were you, said Blackberry. The sun will be down soon.
Ha, said Bigwig. If I meet a stoat, it'd better look out, that's all. I'll bring you one back tomorrow, shall I? He raced off and disappeared over the edge.
Let's go and get the others together, said Holly. Come on, Blackberry. You'll have to tell the whole thing from the beginning.
The 3/4 of a mile in the blazing heat, from Nuthanger to the foot of the hill, had cost Hazel more pain and effort than anything in his life. If Fiver had not found him, he would have died in the drain. When Fiver's urging had penetrated his dark, ebbing stupor, he had at first actually tried not to respond. It was so much easier to remain where he was, on the far side of the suffering he had undergone. Later, when he found himself lying in the green gloom of the ditch, with Fiver searching his wounds and assuring him that he could stand and move, still he could not face the idea of setting out to return. His torn side throbbed, and the pain in his leg seemed to have affected his senses. He felt dizzy and could not hear or smell properly. At last, when he understood that Fiver and Blackberry had risked a second journey to the farm, in the broadest of daylight, solely to find him and save his life, he forced himself to his feet and began to stumble down the slope to the road. His sight was swimming, and he had to stop again and again. Without Fiver's encouragement, he would have lain down once more and given up. In the road, he could not climb the bank and had to limp along the verge until he could crawl under a gate. Much later, as they came under the pylon line, he remembered the overgrown ditch at the foot of the hill and set himself to reach it. Once there, he lay down and at once returned to the sleep of total exhaustion. When Bigwig arrived, just before dark, he found Fiver snatching a quick feed in the long grass. It was out of the question to disturb Hazel by digging, and they spent the night crouched beside him on the narrow floor. Coming out in the grey light before dawn, the first creature Bigwig saw was Kihar, foraging between the elders. He stamped to attract his attention, and Kihar sailed across to him with one beat of his wings and a long glide.
"Mr. Bigwig, you find Mr. Hazel?"
"Yes," said Bigwig.
"He's in the ditch here." "He not dead?" "No, but he's wounded and very weak. The farm man shot him with a gun, you know." "You get Blackstones out?"
"How do you mean?"
"Always with gun is coming little Blackstones. You never see."
"No, I don't know about guns."
"Take out Blackstones, he get better. He come now, yeah?"
"I'll see," said Bigwig. He went down to Hazel and found him awake and talking to Fiver. When Bigwig told him that Kihar was outside, he dragged himself up the short run and into the grass.
"This damn gun," said Kihar. "He put little stones for hurt you. I look, yeah?"
"I suppose you'd better," said Hazel. "My leg's still very bad, I'm afraid."
He lay down, and Kihar's head flicked from side to side as though he were looking for snails in Hazel's brown fur. He peered closely up the length of the torn flank.
"He's not stones here," he said. "Go in, go out, no stop. Now I see your leg. Maybe hurt you not long."
2 shotgun pellets were buried in the muscle of the haunch. Kihar detected them by smell and removed them exactly as he might have picked spiders out of a crack. Hazel had barely time to flinch before Bigwig was sniffing at the pellets in the grass.
"Now he's more bleed," said Kihar. "You stay. Wait maybe 1-2 day. Then good, like before. Those rabbits up there, I'll wait. Wait for Mr. Hazel. I tell them he come."
He flew off before they could reply. As things turned out, Hazel stayed 3 days at the foot of the hill. The hot weather continued, and for much of the time, he
He sat under the elder branches, dozing above ground, like some solitary chlesi, and feeling his strength returning. Fiver stayed with him, keeping the wounds clean and watching his recovery. Often they would say nothing for hours together, lying in the rough, warm grass while the shadows moved to evening, until at last the local blackbird cocked its tail and tuck-tucked away to roost. Neither spoke of Nuthanger Farm, but Hazel showed plainly enough that for the future Fiver, when he gave advice, would have no hard task to get him to accept it.
"Hreru," said Hazel one evening, "what would we have done without you? We'd none of us be here, would we?" "You're sure we are here, then?" asked Fiver.
"That's too mysterious for me," replied Hazel. "What do you mean?"
"Well, there's another place. Another country, isn't there? We go there when we sleep, at other times too, and when we die. El Herrera comes and goes between the two as he wants, I suppose. But I could never quite make that out from the tales. Some rabbits will tell you it's all easy there, compared with the waking dangers that they understand. But I think that only shows they don't know much about it. It's a wild place, and very unsafe. And where are we really? There, or here? Our bodies stay here. That's good enough for me. You'd better go and talk to that silverweed fellow. He might know more. Oh, you remember him? I felt that when we were listening to him, you know. He terrified me, and yet I knew that I understood him better than anyone else in that place. He knew where he belonged, and it wasn't here. Poor fellow. I'm sure he's dead. They've got him, all right, the ones in that country. They don't give their secrets away for nothing, you know. But look, here come Holly and Blackberry. So we'd better feel sure we're here, just for the moment, anyway."
Holly had already come down the hill on the previous day to see Hazel and tell again the story of his escape from Ephrafa. When he had spoken of his deliverance by the great apparition in the night, Fiver had listened attentively and asked one question.
"Did it make a noise?"
Later, when Holly had gone back, he told Hazel that he felt sure there was some natural explanation, though he had no idea what it could be. Hazel, however, had not been greatly interested. For him, the important thing was their disappointment and the reason for it. Holly had achieved nothing, and this was entirely due to the unexpected unfriendliness of the Ephrafan rabbits. This evening, as soon as they had begun to feed, Hazel returned to the matter.
"Holly," he said, "we're hardly any nearer to solving our problem, are we? You've done wonders and got nothing to show for it, and the Nuthanger raid was only a silly lark, I'm afraid, and an expensive one for me at that. The real hole has still got to be dug."
"Well," said Holly, "you say it was only a lark, Hazel, but at least they gave us two does, and they're the only two we've got."
"Are they any good?"
"The kind of ideas that have become natural to many male human beings in thinking of females, ideas of protection, fidelity, romantic love, and so on, are, of course, unknown to rabbits, although rabbits certainly do form exclusive attachments much more frequently than most people realize. However, they are not romantic, and it came naturally to Hazel and Holly to consider the two Nuthanger does simply as breeding stock for the warren. This was what they had risked their lives for."
"Well, it's hard to say yet," replied Holly. "They're doing their best to settle down with us, Clover particularly. She seems very sensible, but they're extraordinarily helpless, you know. I've never seen anything like it, and I'm afraid they may turn out to be delicate in bad weather. They might survive next winter, and then again they might not. But you weren't to know that when you got them out of the farm."
"With a bit of luck, they might each have a litter before the winter," said Hazel.
I know the breeding season's over, but everything's so topsy-turvy with us here that there's no saying.
Well, you ask me what I think, said Holly. I'll tell you. I think they're precious little...